Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. The elections on Tuesday were a stunning rebuke to Trump and the Republicans, with Democrats winning in elections across the country. Is the tide turning? Will Democrats be able to take back the U.S. House and Senate next year? Does the energy unleashed by Trump have the potential to realign the country? We have two guests today to help us analyze the results of this election and what they mean for our country going forward. Our first guest is Joshua Holland, contributor to The Nation magazine, who will talk about what happened around the country. He will be followed by Senator Daniel Squadron, head of a new group called Future Now that's offering a bold agenda for the states and supporting candidates for state legislature. He will talk specifically about the amazing results in the Commonwealth of Virginia, where they were very actively supporting candidates. First up is Joshua Holland, a contributor to The Nation and a fellow with The Nation Institute. He's also the host of Politics and Reality Radio. Joshua Holland, welcome to All Together Now.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate that.
Yeah, so we need your wisdom here. What happened in the election this week, and how big were the wins for Democrats?
It was a massive wave for an odd-numbered year. Democrats won up and down the ballot, coast to coast. And I think that two things happened. First, you had evidence that the so-called resistance has maintained its energy since right after the election. You know, there were dozens of new groups formed to fight the Trump agenda, and there were real questions about whether that kind of enthusiasm from the Democratic coalition is something that could be maintained through 4 years of Trumpism, potentially, and you know, or whether there would be a sense of kind of outrage fatigue might set in, and people would become not accustomed to the Trump era, but less likely to defy the usual patterns of voting, which is that typically Democratic, the groups that skew towards the Democratic Party tend to not turn out in off-year elections. So, you know, we had a lot of enthusiasm from Democrats. I think at the same time, you know, we've seen hundreds of news stories about how Trump supporters are sticking by him through thick and thin. They're not deterred by any of the what they see as fake news. But that doesn't necessarily mean that support is translated into enthusiasm to get out to the polls. So I think that you had a combination of a really mobilized progressive base. You have a lot of new organizations that were working to get people out to the polls. I know in my own district, which is a Trump district, I got...
Where do you live?
I live in the Hudson Valley, about 100 miles north of New York City. And I got a half dozen calls from a local group that, you know, has really been hitting the pavement trying to get this area organized, telling me to get out to the polls. I think that we've seen that everywhere. And that combination is a really good outcome for Democrats.
Yeah, it was really stunning. And I think you're right about the energy that people, those of us who are appalled by what Trump is doing and saying, that there was the question, well, you've got all this resistance going, you're marching in the streets. It's like every week here in Washington, D.C., we have another rally against Trump or rally on climate change or rally for women. But the question was, would that energy and that activity show up at the ballot box where it really counts? And it looks from the results on Tuesday, that is a big yes. People who are very concerned about Trump made it to the polls on Tuesday, and we're hoping they're going to show up again next year when they have the congressional elections. So tell us a little bit about some of the candidates who won. We had, the big race of, two big ones, governor in Virginia and in New Jersey. And we get Chris Christie there, been in for 8 years, probably the least popular governor in the history of polling, down at 14%. And the Democrat running for governor won a resounding victory there. So we got that governorship and then also in Virginia. What did you see happening in the two governor's races?
Well, I think that the really important thing to understand is that control of state houses going to the 2020 census is vitally important. And one of the most significant outcomes from Tuesday is that Democrats will now have, at a minimum, depending on how things shake out in 2018 and 2020, at a minimum, if things hold in the Virginia legislature, they're going to have a veto power over the redrawing of electoral maps in Virginia. It's entirely possible that the outcome from Tuesday will cause Northam to reopen a debate over expanding the state's Medicaid to low-income residents making up to 138% of the poverty line. These are hugely important, hugely consequential results. It looks like Virginia, New Jersey, and Washington State, which flipped control of the state Senate, are poised to expand access to the ballot, while we see red states adding more onerous voting restrictions. Control of the state house has been something that I think Democrats have lapsed in recent years in terms of contesting down ballot state house races, and it's vitally, vitally important. In Washington, they also put kind of the final brick in what they're calling a blue wall. Democrats now have unified control of state governments in Washington, Oregon, and California, the entire Pacific West Coast. And what they're doing out there is they're sketching out an aggressive progressive agenda between those states. They're going to do various cooperative agreements about perhaps a carbon pricing plan. They're talking to leaders from other countries, actually, about possibly integrating those states into a larger carbon trading scheme. These are hugely important victories in the bigger picture. You have this huge solid chunk of the country that is going to be a model for various kinds of progressive legislation in the coming years. So, it's hard to overstate the impact of Tuesday's victories. The other thing that was striking, when you look at kind of the candidates who won, is just how many firsts there were. First woman of color to win the mayor of Charlotte. We had the first transgender candidate ever to be seated in a state legislature. There was another one who won in New Hampshire, but she was not actually seated. And up and down, you see this kind of, rejection of the narrow white nationalist agenda pushed by Steve Bannon and Donald Trump and that bunch. It was remarkable how much the outcome of this election was appeared to be a repudiation of the last one.
Right, exactly. And as you say, there's some very exciting firsts. I mean, to have the black woman winning the mayor's race in Charlotte, North Carolina is just stunning, given race relations in that area. And you mentioned the transgender woman who won in the state house race in Virginia. Danica Rome, exactly. And the interesting thing about her, aside from she's the first transgender person elected, that she actually was running against Robert Marshall, who's 73 years old, is kind of the homophobe in chief in Virginia. I mean, self-called. He probably is anti-gay. and that she, the transgender candidate, ran against this chief homophobe in Virginia and knocked him out. And, you know, it's just absolutely stunning, some of these. And as you say, we got, say, Elizabeth Guzman, the immigrant from Peru who won a state House seat, beating a retired Army colonel in a Republican-leaning suburb of Washington. So, you know, just some very amazing. It's like America coming home to herself.
I really think that that's right. I mean, I look at the election of Ravinder Bala. He's a Sikh American. He was elected mayor of Hoboken. And, you know, we've seen so much animosity. Obviously, Sikhs are not Muslims, but they wear turbans, and they've been the subject of a lot of accidental Islamophobia, if you will. They've been subjected to attacks because by people who perceive them as Muslims. And you see that in the midst of all of these, you know, very, very brutal kind of protests against mosques that we've seen in New Jersey lately, here the Hoboken mayor is a brown guy who wears a turban. And you see this in race after race, these down-ballot races. It's been a remarkable thing. I mean, it really is. It's hard to overstate how kind of surprising it has been. I was expecting a pretty good night on Tuesday, simply because the out party tends to do well in off-year elections when the president is not terribly popular. This is a fairly consistent pattern. But I don't think anybody anticipated the kind of wave that we saw. I know people were expecting Democrats to perhaps pick up 9 to 10 seats in the Virginia House of Delegates. There are a couple of races that haven't been called, but it looks like they're north of 15, and nobody expected that.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And you know, some of this, too, we need to give some credit to the women who both ran for office in big numbers and also showed up to vote in big numbers and voted Democratic in big numbers. So we have, for example, in Helena, Montana, a woman who is a refugee from Liberia has become the first black mayor in Helena, Montana. And even in Seattle, electing its first female mayor in a century. So, you know, what do you think about the role of women in this election this week?
Well, I mean, I think that you've hit it on the head. What we saw in Virginia was really interesting. There were a lot of first-time candidates, women candidates on the ballot. And it appears that there was a kind of reverse coattails where they generated more enthusiasm. Democratic turnout was higher in districts where there was a challenger to a Republican delegate than it was in districts without a challenger. So in other words, it was all of this influx of fresh blood into the political system that really excited voters to turn out and actually increase the numbers for the people at the top of the ticket, Northam, Herring, the lieutenant governor. And, you know, I think that it kind of reflects the face of the resistance. The resistance movement, by and large, and I'm not saying exclusively so, has been driven by women, by middle-aged women. Like, that's the prime demographic that have been turning out in the streets and have been organizing a lot of these new organizations that have sprung up since the election. And I think that part of that is that, you know, the election of Donald Trump after revelations that he was a serial sexual harasser was a real slap in the face. And I think that, you know, we're seeing a backlash among women, and that's a positive thing, obviously, in this context. There's an element of not revenge, but, you know, a righteous fury.
Oh, that's good. I love that. Righteous fury. I think you're absolutely right. And I was there, with 3 million other people in the Women's March the day after Trump was inaugurated. And I have never seen anything like it. 3 million people. I think that's probably the largest demonstration in the history of the world. And I was right here in Washington, D.C., right at the stage. And it was so mobbed. People were shoulder to shoulder. You kind of worried you're going to get crushed. There were so many people there. But everybody was alert, active, ready to take action, very concerned. And it was good in the sense that there wasn't anger. Or just say it isn't really revenge or anger. But there is definite a fierce determination that we will not stand by and watch Trump and the Republicans turn back the clock and do all kinds of legislation and policies that hurt women, that hurt family, that hurt children, that hurt health care, that hurt America, and that women said we have to stand up and take action. And boy, did they act. I mean, you mentioned about the 15 new delegates in the state of Virginia. 11 of the 15 Democratic challengers who won there were, in districts held by Republicans, were women. I loved it. My favorite story on connecting to the Women's March is the woman in New Jersey, Ashley Bennett, who's a hospital employee, and she ran against this Republican who had ridiculed the Women's March, and she had never been that involved before, never run for office before, but she saw him ridiculing the Women's March, and she says, I'm going to take your seat, and she runs against him, and she wins. I mean, just like amazing stuff. But I think it's what you're talking about. The influx of new blood is excited the voters, and they said, we need new people in there. And boy, did they come out in droves to vote for the Democrats, to turn out the Republicans, and to vote against Trump.
That was a particularly delicious victory in New Jersey against that kind of jerkish guy who made fun of the Women's March. Soon after the election, I interviewed a number of people who were organizing these so-called resistance groups, people who were starting new organizations in an attempt to fill what they saw as some gap in the existing progressive/democratic infrastructure. And the story that I heard again and again and again was, I never paid a lot of attention to politics, but this time it was personal. And unlike the election of, say, George W. Bush, who was an extremely conservative president who did a lot of damage to the social safety net, this had a visceral quality. That's why I keep coming back to that idea that, when he said he would grab women by the genitals, that was a different kind of affront. And you could look at it in a different way, which is, Trump has brought to the surface kind of some of the ugliest aspects of conservative politics, things that were not at the surface, that were buried beneath the surface. The Republicans have long, engaged in kind of dog whistle politics where there would be a wink and a nudge, and you could say, wow, that seems a little racist to me, but it was never explicit. And here you had a guy that came down that golden escalator talking about how Mexicans were mostly rapists, so maybe there were some good ones. And the white nationalist politics of Steve Bannon, it's so egregious and in your face that they see this country as a country belonging to straight white people. That is just, it's impossible to avoid, even if you're not a political junkie, even if you're a casual observer of politics. This was making subtext into text. He has a gift for making it extremely clear, these things that were somewhat obscured under past conservative regimes. So, you know, it's understandable that we would see this kind of backlash, because a lot of people out there in this country feel personally threatened by the regime in a way that they didn't feel threatened by a softer conservative, by a Reagan or a Bush, you know?
Right, exactly right. It's so true. And I think the fact that Trump just kind of ripped off the mask of some of the racist underbelly in the Republican politics and just was blatantly racist and misogynist, to a certain extent, that excited his base. But that's, you know, maybe we're looking at a third of the country that kind of supports that approach. But then it's like two-thirds of the country's going, no, that's not who we are. And in some ways, it's like Trump being as ugly and, as you say, the Steve Bannon politics of white nationalism, it's so egregiously visible that we can look at it unmasked, and it's like the deep, dark, ugly sides of America just full-blown up on a giant screen for us to be watching every day. And it gives us the opportunity to really make a choice and go, is that who we are? Are we going to let that stand? And if not, then we need to organize and we need to run for office and we need to get out and vote. And what you're saying about this time, it's personal. And this time, it's really visceral. I know, you know, for me, for a lot of women, I feel that way, a lot of people of color, going, you know, we have to stand up to this, and they did. It's interesting in the Virginia race for governor that the men kind of split about 50-50 for the Democrat and the Republican, but the women went for the Democrat by like 61-39. It was like a real hands down women voting out the Republican, and the Republican who ran for the governorship in Virginia was exactly the worst parts of what you're talking about, the, you know, the racist white nationalist politics. He was running these horrendous ads. So it was really great to see Virginia step up and say, no, we're not going to tolerate that, and we're going to go, you know, back to the America, the land of the free, the home of the brave, the place where immigrants are welcome from all over the world, and we can live together in peace and make a great country.
Yeah, I really think that's true. I mean, Ed Gillespie, the Republican candidate, he tried to have his cake and eat it too. He was running those ridiculously demagogic ads with Latino gangsters coming to kill you, et cetera, et cetera. He was running that in the hoop of energizing Trump voters in the southern part of the state. At the same time, he kept Trump at arm's length personally. Trump did not campaign with him at his request in order to try to not elicit a backlash from the bluer areas of the state, the Washington suburbs, the northern part of the state, and it backfired woefully. I don't think that people who were inclined to support Trump because of his white supremacist, I don't want to say dog whistles, his white supremacist rhetoric, believed that Ed Gillespie, who is a creature of the Republican establishment, who, you know, has long been a kind of big business Republican, I don't think they believed that he was earnest in his racial demagoguery. And at the same time, that stuff was front and center in the campaign, and it did, in fact, elicit exactly the kind of backlash from the blue Virginia that he was trying to avoid. So he was trying to have it both ways, and he ended up underperforming his polls by several points. It was really a significant rebuke of that kind of politics. It's interesting. We will see going into 2018 what lessons other Republicans take away from that race. The race in New Jersey also featured a lot of racial messages from the Republican? Will they think, okay, this is not something that is smart because it does energize the other side? Or will they run on that because they see that it worked for Trump and don't really have much in the way of a message beyond that?
Right.
This is an open question for 2018.
Exactly. And speaking of lessons, you mentioned the lessons that the Republicans might learn. What are some of the lessons you think the Democrats can learn that will help Democrats win more seats in Congress next year?
Well, I think that this really depends on what kind of district you're in. One of the interesting things about Northam is that, progressives were not terribly enthusiastic about him.
Right.
Kind of milquetoast, kind of, not
moderate,
not terribly aggressive in terms of criticizing Trump, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you're running in an environment that is very much against the other side, there is something to be said of letting them motivate your voters. In other words, you don't want to activate the other side's base if the other side's base is demoralized and yours is energetic. But I think it varies a lot by district. One thing that is a clear takeaway, though, if you look at the exit polls, a top issue in Virginia was health care. And among those who put that at the top of their agenda, Northam absolutely slaughtered Gillespie. I don't recall the actual numbers, but it was it was something on the range of 70-30. So, the Republicans have put themselves in a bit of a rough place in that they have taken repeated votes to deprive 20-plus million people of health care without actually delivering repeal to their base. So their base is seeing nothing in terms of promises kept to destroy the Affordable Care Act, and yet our base is, has seen them take these very, very difficult votes, and I expect to see a very, very pointed focus on hanging those votes on lawmakers. Next year. I mean, this is the ads write themselves. Candidate X voted to take health care away from 24 million people in order to give a big tax cut to his donors. It's an easy line of attack because it's true, and it's they pursued ghastly and profoundly immoral policies, and they should pay a price for it.
Right, exactly. Well, you mentioned about the health care being the most important issue in the minds of voters in Virginia on Tuesday when they voted, and it came out 39% put it as their top issue, is more than twice as high of any other issue there.
Yep.
And you're right. Among those who put health care first, which was most of the people, 77% of them went for the Democrat. And they're not, only 23% went for the Republican. They do not see the Republicans as someone who's going to help them with their health care. And I think this is a big warning signal for the Republicans as they're moving into their big tax cut for the rich bill that they're trying to slam through. Hopefully this will help put the brakes on that when they realize actually the voters are paying attention and the voters want policies that are going to help the middle class, not more tax breaks to the rich.
Yeah, I really hope that the results from Tuesday has a demonstrable effect on the effort to ramp through this tax reform bill. It was already very difficult, just given the various stakeholders who were going to lose out. When you close a loophole, you're killing somebody's deduction, and there was always going to be very, very difficult trade-offs and compromise. We saw this with the state income taxes. The Republican leadership wanted to kill that deduction. They're still in there, which hurts blue states, which tend to have higher income taxes. And yet there are representatives from those blue states who are like, wait a second, this is going to kill me back home. So they already had a difficult task, and I am certainly hoping that these results put a little bit of fear of not God, but the electorate into them. And the other thing that we're seeing is a number of resignations.
As it should be. I'm sorry to say that's all the time we have, but
yes.
Joshua Holland, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate that.
Up next is Daniel Squadron, co-founder and executive director of the new group called Future Now, which supports candidates who push for progress on ambitious, measurable goals in local state governments to drive nationwide change. He was a member of the New York State Senate from 2008 until earlier this year. Daniel Squadron, welcome back to All Together Now.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back, and even more exciting than a week ago.
Really? What a difference a week makes, huh? So, first of all, I want to thank you for the role you played in the Virginia elections last week. I know Future Now was very, very involved in that. So for our listeners who have not been paying close attention, just tell us briefly what happened in the election this week in Virginia.
Well, the entire Virginia House of Delegates was up for election, the 100-seat House. It went in. You needed to flip 17 seats to flip the majority. It was a majority that had, done such highlights as preventing the expansion of Medicaid for 400,000 Virginians, restricted voting rights. So it was the kind of majority that had to change. And on election day, I think that we exceeded everyone's expectations in Virginia. 14, depending on recounts, between 14 and 17 Democrats won seats.
That's amazing.
If sort of everything goes in the best possible way in recounts, it will actually flip the majority. Even if not, the message is just extraordinary. Future Now Fund was really pleased and proud to support 10 insurgent candidates all running to flip a seat, all endorsers of America's Goals, which is our framework to make measurable, ambitious progress in states. And on election night, 10 out of 10 of our candidates, our insurgents, were ahead. And we're still confident all 10 will win. 9 are out of even the zone of recounts, and 1, Dante Tanner, is going to be in a recount. But we're confident that when all is said and done, just like on election night, he will end up ahead.
Well, that's totally awesome. You must be absolutely thrilled.
You know, we really are. The truth is, and this was true of Future Now Fund's effort in Virginia. It was true of some of the other groups, too. You know, our goal was to go in there and help the candidates who most needed it. So, you know, even in a best-case scenario, we were thinking 7 or 8 victories would be dramatic. Frankly, if you'd asked me on Monday, 3 or 4 victories would have still been a positive sign for the change and the energy that's out there. Our analysis was that we were doing better than that. But to have 10 out of 10 ahead on election night, to have additional candidates around the state win at this level really is a sign of something. And, you know, it's interesting because there are actually 17 districts going to Election Day in Virginia that were won by Hillary Clinton but were held by Republicans. And the reason that the Virginia House of Delegates had such an imbalance relative to that national result was a combination of some really, really pernicious gerrymandering, some of the worst anywhere out there, and also the fact that, this is just a fact, certain candidates do better in odd-year elections and midterm elections and presidential elections, and generally that odd-year election that you have in Virginia for the legislature and for the governor. You know, frankly, fewer folks, progressives and folks voting for Democrats have come out for in the past. And what you saw was you saw a surge in energy because folks realize that state legislatures and state governments really matter. You know, we know that folks out there are galvanized by the brewing political crisis that we see around the country and certainly in the White House. And I really believe that the kind of affirmative vision that so many of these candidates, and we're talking about each one of these candidates, each one is more inspiring and has better leadership qualities than the next. It's really extraordinary. But in addition to sort of who they are, talking about actually solving people's problems, talking about health care for hundreds of thousands of Virginians, talking about whether people will be able to exercise their right to vote, the things that America's goals are trying to bring to states, I think people really buy is worth their focus and their energy, and it's a risk. And, you know, I got to tell you, if things don't go well, I think people get discouraged about government and discouraged about states again, you know, in a heartbeat, in an election cycle. But I think in this moment, people are willing to take that gamble, and that's really exciting.
Yeah, fantastic. And were you out in the field much in Virginia? Did you get a sense of how much of that vote was for a positive agenda? How much of it was, you know, to give notice to Trump, we don't like what you're, and the Republicans, we don't like what you're doing? Could you tell at all?
You know, we were in kind of constant touch with the campaigns. I really do. And, you know, I was in the state Senate. I like nothing more than knocking doors in my district and often doing it. I unfortunately didn't get the chance personally to do that ahead of Election Day. But in terms of the contact we had with volunteers on the ground, the contact we had with the campaigns, it was there. You know, it's funny you say, was it sort of enthusiasm for the candidates or anger at or negative feeling about Trump? And the answer is those two things are related. You know, anger at Trump, fear of the way that he seems to operate with his judgment, I think gets people more open to being involved in politics. But then the reason they stuck, the reason they voted, the reason you had enormous numbers of volunteers and folks on the doors for these candidates and energy for, you know, for the kind of elections, let's face it, most of the time can't get many hearts outside of the immediate family of the candidates and sometimes not even there, is because people, once they took a look at this, realized that there was something really exciting, that they could have an impact. You know, the number one thing, this was true when I was in the state Senate, in my own district, this has been true since we've launched Future Now. The number one question I get asked, and I'm sure you get asked too, by the way, is what can we do? How do we have an impact? I don't like where this country's going. By the way, and that's almost across the board. That's people who voted for Donald Trump, people who voted for Hillary Clinton, people who didn't find either of them worth voting for, unfortunately. Across the board, people know that they've got to do more, and they don't know how. And the thing that we saw in Virginia is that the answer is states and especially state legislatures, because every action you take, whether it's a dollar contributed or an hour knocking doors or a vote cast, has a vastly outsized influence there. And so when you talk, and then I think what we're going to see, or what I hope we see in the Virginia House of Delegates this year and state houses across the country when they go into session over the next few months, is that faith and energy about states isn't just the best possible way to have an impact to swing an election. It's also the best possible way to get policies enacted, the kind of policies that we all know we need to enact for our future, but that too often feel impossible in the current political climate.
Right, exactly. And that goes to a point you raised the last time you were on this show about people, when we do get active, can have a bigger impact at the state level. So it's very enticing when you do kind of wake up and go, actually, my vote matters. Who I give money to matters. Who I volunteer for matters. Then if you get engaged in these state legislative races, your participation can make a big difference for a candidate who's, you know, trying to get, you know, enough votes to hit that, you know, over 50% to win.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, and we saw a big turnout surge in Virginia. But we're talking about, you know, this real national movement that we saw on the ground in Virginia, and talking about, you know, 24,000, 30,000 votes total cast. You know, when you talk about the ability of someone who really gets invested in an election over a period of time, I mean a volunteer, I mean, you know, a regular citizen who's got a full-time job but who wants to make a difference, you know, you can really swing hundreds of votes. When you're talking about vote totals where folks are up or down, in one case it's 12 votes, and in another case, you know, in the low hundreds of votes, it can be the difference maker. Now, here's the challenge. Because this, it really was proof of that for Election Day and for any one of your listeners who's ever doubted that they can have an impact in an election. It's true they might not be able to have as much impact as they'd like in a presidential election, though they should get involved, or even a statewide election. But in a state legislative election, they can be the difference maker. But here's the question, is can we figure out how to get state legislatures, once they organize and are operating, to convince people that they're going to be listened to for the kinds of goals they have for their state, the kinds of goals that we're putting forward in America's goals. And that is the next challenge, to take this victory and this wave, which I think was initially driven by a frustration about what's happening with Donald Trump and a fear of what he's doing to our politics and our country, just in terms of his tone in addition to his policies. And can we turn that into a lasting change that convinces people that a progressive, bold, ambitious vision for states and our country is attainable?
Right, exactly. That will be coming up soon. So talk to us a little bit about who were some of the 10 people that Future Now supported, the candidates who ran and won in this amazing turnout in Virginia. Are there one or two people who kind of stand out for you as particularly striking, that you're just really kind of surprised that they won?
Well, no, there aren't one or two. There are more than that among the 10. You know, it's, I'm serious when I say, you know, candidate to candidate, one is more exciting than the next. Jennifer Carol Foy, she's a public defender. She's African-American woman who graduated from the Virginia Military Institute, which is itself an exceptional thing. She's been a foster mom. She had a child during the campaign. And she just kept going out there and meeting her district and won handily. Elizabeth Guzman and Hala Ayala together are going to be the first Latina members of the Virginia House of Delegates in history. And
that's exciting.
Elizabeth, it absolutely is. Elizabeth came to this country. She's been a social worker in public service. Hala has been involved in all kinds of civic and public engagement for years. Was on Governor McCullough's Women's Council, and they both won. Kathy Tran came here as a child, as a refugee from Vietnam. She's going to be the first Asian American elected to the Virginia House of Delegates. She's a mother of four, and you know, first time candidate who really got involved the way so many of us did. Sort of based on a Trump moment, a post-election kind of, you know, realization that it wasn't just about that single election or that single person, though, you know, we certainly use his name a lot, but it was about a politics that we need more people involved in. You know, candidate after candidate, Chris Hurst, who is from southwestern part of the state, you know, part of the state where historically, not only Democrats haven't performed, Democrats haven't even competed in many cases. He was a successful news anchor, and he was galvanized to be in politics after his live-in girlfriend, Allison Parker, was murdered on the air in a terrible gun crime, along with the cameraman. She was also a reporter. And it got him involved. But, you know, he ran, like so many of these candidates, on don't elect me because of my personal story. I want you to know who I am and why I'm running, but elect me because we need better services on the district level, and a state legislature that is less captured by a narrow band of interest and more responsive to needs and shared values that exist across the political spectrum. Expansion of affordable health care. The fact that if you live in the country and you're a citizen, you have other rules, you know, voting should be something that is a reasonable prospect for you. And that's how each of these candidates won. They had these great inspiring stories. They were themselves, you know, inspiring sort of speakers and leaders. And they offered voters a reason to come out there and get involved in state elections that often, you know, the fact is, we have to be honest, a whole lot of people sit out.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, I've been out there on campaigns trying to drum up interest in kind of the so-called off-year elections. And it's really hard, you know, it's trying to even get 20% of the people to turn out is sometimes a huge success. It's like, where's the other 80% of the voters? Come on, get in the game. You can't win the game if you're not on the field. So I think this time we got a great crew of people on the field, and we were talking just earlier in the show about the role of women in this election, and that there in Virginia, 11 of the 15 Democratic challengers who won in districts held by Republicans were women. And, you know, several of the ones you talked about, you know, it's just amazing to me. You talk about Elizabeth Guzman. She's an immigrant from Peru. She's now elected to the Virginia State House. So, and the refugee from Vietnam, it's just, it's great. It's like, it's the rising of America. You know, and the rising of the America that we know and love, the multicultural, multiracial, multiethnic, where people come from around the world, and everybody has a shot at the American dream. And we're I'm just thrilled to see Virginians turning out to say that's the America we believe in and that we want to vote for.
Well, it's a really important point that you make, and you know, it's one that bears repeating, which is it absolutely is what we talk about when we talk about American values. We talk about people being able to come here and adopt this country and serve it because they've adopted this country and our values and our ideas. It's mm-hmm. about people whose voices have too often been left out of the conversation, getting into the conversation, not just for their own voice, but so that they can better serve and create outcomes. But, you know, it's really important that we remember that if just a, you know, somewhat fewer people, in fact, in the kind of number of people that in 2015 or 2013 or 2011 would have turned out, then the story would have appeared to be a different one. We
right.
would have the same country we have, and we saw rising on Tuesday, because the people who didn't vote would still have these same beliefs and the same vision of our country and our future. The only difference is, it would appear that that wasn't a rising tide in this country because too many of those folks didn't have their voices heard in the election. So, you know, that is a story that we are able to tell today because more people participated, because it was a broader conversation. And that's really exciting. The broader the conversation, the more folks who participate, the more it reflects the kind of shared values that I actually really do believe go beyond being partisan values that are the best of what our country has been and can be. And the fewer people who participate, the more limited it is, the more people stay on the sidelines or are kept on the sidelines, the more the story appears to be a much uglier one, one that's not true, but one that does, you know, too frequently win elections.
Right, exactly. Talk a little bit about the role that Future Now played. I know you've got a wonderful, dynamic, progressive program, a set of policies that you ask candidates to sign on to. Maybe say a little bit about what exactly did the candidates Future Now endorse agree to advance, and then what kind of support did you give those candidates?
Right. Well, this is another exciting thing that happened. You know, we have these set of goals that we call America's goals, which are seven broad shared values: good jobs, affordable quality health care, investing in children, equal opportunity for all, better, more sustainable and resilient infrastructure, clean air, water, and energy. And we have three measurable targets attached to each of those seven, and asked candidates if they would sort of commit to work towards these in a way that makes sense for Virginia, makes sense for their district, but also makes sense for the future. And these 10 candidates enthusiastically got behind them. But in addition to that, another more than a dozen got behind them. And so, you know, we talked about the 10 candidates who
Future Now Fund, excuse me, was able to endorse and provide some significant financial support to and partner with the campaigns whenever possible. But in addition to that, another eight candidates were successful on Election Day who have signed on to America's goals. We have a pledge at futurenowusa.org that is a pledge to just work to achieve these goals over the course of one's time in office or regular people across the population can sign on to. And we actually are now going to have, assuming the Dante Tanner victory does end up coming through, which I believe it will, we're going to end up with an 18-member America's Goals Caucus entering the Virginia House of Delegates when they go back into session. That's nearly a fifth of the House, 40% of the Democratic Caucus, who have signed on to a vision that has specific measurable targets. So the Virginians know, in addition to the service that they get in the district, in addition to the constituent response that I know these candidates are going to give, the kind of values they're going to get from the legislature. And that's a very big deal to right out of the gate, within a month of launching these goals, have the kind of response we've had from candidates and the ability to partner. So, you know, we partnered in the election, but we also plan to continue that partnership now that the election is over. We want to work with these candidates who, you know, it can be hard. I know from my own time in the legislature, it can be hard to kind of pull back from the day-to-day or the issues that are being driven by narrow special interests and remember that kind of longer-term vision. So we plan to partner with them to give them basically a menu of options and policy ideas and statistics and facts and whatever they need, frankly, to work towards these goals. Things like in our good jobs goal, the measurable targets are 100% of jobs pay a livable take-home wage, 100% of jobs have paid family medical and vacation leave, 100% of jobs have basic worker rights, and the workers have the right to organize, or our quality affordable health care goal, which I've already said, you know, includes affordable coverage with a cap and out-of-pocket expenses, includes an increase in life expectancy to 84 years. We're the richest country in the world. It's appalling that other countries are living longer than we are, and an end to hunger. On each of those, we're going to be connecting these candidates or these delegates-elect to the resources to find the best solutions for Virginia. By the way, if folks are interested in some of these goals and have ideas for solutions from their own states or anywhere else, they can visit our website, futurenowusa.org. Futurenowusa.org. They can read the goals. They can read about the candidates. And most importantly, they can contact us because there's no single path to these solutions. But the claim that there's no path at all to them, you know, has taken too much hold in politics, and we have to put that to rest.
Yeah, exactly. That's so exciting. And, you know, for our listeners who might not have been involved in state legislative action, you know, to understand what you're talking about in terms of a focus for the goals and policy and this kind of support you're talking about with the clarity of, you know, here's some key goals, here's some ways that you can have solutions to our problems and measure your progress towards solving these problems, that's just invaluable because so many of our state legislators really don't have the money to hire staff to support them. So they're trying to make decisions and vote on every conceivable area of policy and yet often lack the policy substance, resources, analysis, data, you know, anything that can help them make an informed decision. You know, sometimes they're really missing that. And the fact that you've got Future Now and you're providing that kind of clarity and research and data to the candidates is really, I mean, to the elected officials at the state level is very exciting.
And, you know, in the absence of it, this is just another sort of reality. In the absence of that, you're left with just the high-powered lobbyists who, you know, are paid to full-time walk the halls of the Capitol. And
you know, have information at their fingertips. Unfortunately, it's the information that benefits their clients' interests, not necessarily the public interest. And there's not nearly enough of the kind of honest, transparent, goals-oriented policy support that folks want. You know, I'm a big believer that people get into public service, certainly these candidates we're talking about today, but in general, across the board, for the most part, people get into public service because they believe in public service. It's got enough difficulties. But once you're there, so few of the structures are in place to help folks follow their better angels or help folks even step back and remember their long-term goals, the kind of goals that America's goals and our targets put out there. So, you know, our view is we don't so much want to make, force the elected officials to be better than they are. We want to help them be as good as we know they want and plan to be. And, you know, that's especially true in Virginia when you have this new class of inspiring individuals heading in. They're already eons ahead of what we see in a lot of places because of how they got there. You know, winning a competitive election, winning an election by knocking on doors and asking for people's votes is a great way to remind you what public service is, how you got there, and most importantly, how you can be sent away from it if it doesn't work out.
Absolutely. We have just 1 minute to go. I'd love to know, given your success in Virginia and the great model you've got going, what are your plans for the 2018 elections?
So, you know, we want to continue the momentum. We believe that what happened in Virginia has the capacity to happen around the country, but won't happen on its own. We think that state legislative candidates need financial support, but also are enthusiastic. We have more than 80 candidates from more than 27 states who have signed on to the pledge to achieve America's goals already. And so we are going to target having an impact in state elections, support the best candidates who are most likely to be able to have the biggest impact in their states. And I believe that this wave in 2017 is going to continue in 2018. And I believe that the kind of framework we have where we partner with great candidates, we get them elected into positions of influence, and then we continue the story that state legislatures really can succeed at making a difference in people's lives. That's how you take a wave and you actually change the shoreline for the long term. And so that's our goal in 2018. We'd love as many people to be involved in our movement as possible. FutureNowUSA.org is the website to do it. And again, folks can sign on to the pledge, whether they're public officials or private citizens. And folks can reach out to us with sort of their preferred path to each of our 21 targets, and we'd love to see it. You know, I got to tell you, you learn something every day when people get involved.
Fantastic. That's all the time we have. Daniel Squardon, thank you so much for being with us today and for your great work in Virginia and for America.
Thanks so much. Great talking to you as always.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.